You all are just some incredible, incredible human beings. And I just feel incredibly privileged. Two things.
Yes. I noticed that when you were speaking, and you talked a lot, it sounds like you work with a lot of men, and you had a men sponsor. Sometimes people think that's, oh my God, no. Okay, so I'm just kind of curious.
Okay. I've also had tons of female sponsors. I'm kind of like a sponsor slut. I'm kidding. What it is, when I didn't really get into this too much this weekend, but usually when I give my pitch, I talk about this. You know, I was 2 years abstinent from alcohol when I got introduced to the Big Book. And the man who qualified me and the man who, 12-stepped me is a man who was visiting from California, and he was doing the last workshop that he was doing on, in the Western Hemisphere, and he was going to live in India for 5 years with the Dalai Lama. And I'm in this meeting dying, and my sponsor and I decided to go to this meeting. It was a Big Book meeting. It was called Carry This Message. I'm not Carry This Message, sorry, Common Solution. My sponsor at the time decided to go to this meeting to judge these Big Book numbers. And at the time, I was actually contemplating suicide, because I knew I couldn't drink. I had a small daughter, and I was abstinent from alcohol, and I was, you know, planning on who was going to take care of my child. I was actually writing out a will. And my sponsor calls me and says, let's go hate the Big Book numbers. And I'm like, sure! You know, because I didn't know about the book. All I knew is those people walked in there, and they all looked the same, and they all said the same thing. They're like, God separated me from alcohol, and I wanted to punch them in the face. And they all did the same stuff. It was like, I called it the Big Book cult. I was really mean. Cause I didn't understand it, cause nobody explained the Big Book to me. I just saw these people who looked funny and acted weird and said the same thing. And so we went to this meeting, and here's, this man, his name is Joe, and if Captain Kangaroo and David Crosby had sex and had a love child, this is what this guy looked like. Captain Kangaroo. And I was angry, you know, because I had two emotions, rage and homicidal ideation and suicidal ideation. So it was rage and suicidal depression, and that was what I knew. So he comes, he's talking about the 9-step, and he's saying stuff like all and, you know, you're not them, and wherever, and I raise my hand, and I froth at the mouth, and tell him about how, you know, you don't know, and if you had my life, and the story that we all tell, right, you know, and those people, they owe me amends, I don't owe them an amends, I'll make an amends to them when, you know, the hell freezes over, right, and he smiles, that smile, you get when you get that crazy newcomer who's really on the brink of a breakthrough, they're either going to break down or breakthrough, right, and he smiled. And he was like, yeah, I'll talk to you after the meeting. Didn't argue with me, nothing. Like, didn't even get offended. He laughed. He said, y'all know this one. He said, I'm sorry I disturbed you on the question of alcoholism. Let me talk to you about that after the meeting. Damn it! And so after the meeting, he qualified me. But in the area, there were no women who worked the steps out of the book. There weren't. I met one, her name was Kat, and I met her when I was already 5 or 6 years abstinent from alcohol, and I had been working the steps for 4 years, and she lived an hour and 20 minutes away from me, and I drove to her house for an hour and 20 minutes one way every week to go through the book with that woman, because there were no women who did this. There was no men who did this, and if they did, they were few and far between, and there were no women. That's why I was the guinea pig. It was, does this work on girls? So my home group was a bunch of guys who were doing Joe and Charlie and Back to Basics, and then they found Joe and Mark and Don, and then they started importing people from West Coast, Texas, and Colorado to our home group to teach us how to do this. So they were boys. So yeah, some of my sponsors have been men. And it wasn't because it wasn't for any other reason but necessity. I have sponsored men. Most, 85% of the men that I've sponsored are either gay or transgendered, so they were men, may have started out as men, but they ended up being women. By the time I was done with them, my husband has a whole... And the few that I've had two that were women who became men. So, North Jersey and Montclair, and those of you who know North Jersey, it's a very eclectic, vibrant area. And Park Slope of New Jersey, or at least Greenwich Village. You know, so there's a lot of alternative lifestyles. So I have sponsored men. I have heard men's inventory. I've had, with permission, somebody said, like, hey, look, you know, it came to me in meditation that I really need to have a woman hear this inventory. Would you be willing to hear it? Yes, I'm careful about it. You know, I hear that inventory outside or in a public place. I ask permission from my husband. Anytime gay or straight men ask me to sponsor him, I ask my husband permission. He asks me permission. I prefer to sponsor women. I prefer to have female sponsors. But there are times and circumstances when we do that. So when you hear he or she, or you hear that, that's kind of how that has happened for me. But I'm going to tell you that I've only sponsored two straight guys, and I'll never do that again. And that's been my experience. It's like I did the whole, I'm so spiritual, I can fix horniness. It's really uncomfortable when you're on their sex inventory. And when that happened, and I was like, wait a minute, you were what? I realized that I'm not spiritual enough to do that. So I don't sponsor straight men anymore, but I do sponsor gay men, or gay women, or transgendered. Anywhere in between. The Rainbow Coalition. Does that kind of help you a little bit? But my sponsor right now has a vagina. But I have spiritual advisors who do not. Make sense? We had one person, I saw somebody, and they were kind of, the little recorder thing was going around, and there was an immense story, and I really, really, he got missed, and I'd like to be able to hear that before we go on. Is that okay with you guys? And one last little, I love immense stories anyway, they're awesome, they're like hope, experience, strength, and hope in such a beautiful way. So I'd like to just kind of get you, I know, because I stole it from you, and so...
I'm Andy, alcoholic. My sponsor, Daryl, always used the how free do you want to be terminology with me as well. And in my amends, I did the vast majority of it when I wasn't drinking. Just if I felt like I was carrying anything in my life and it was still with me at this age, I don't care how far back it went. And one of those stories was when I was 14 years old, and I was in an Explorer Scouts group, and part of what we did was we volunteered, or for the church that we met at, they had a booth at State Fairgrounds, and we would volunteer and work this booth as a way to get money for the group itself. And I made my rounds, I cooked, I waited, and I bussed and did dishes. And one of the steps was working the cash register. And when I was at the cash register, I took $30. And nobody knew it. But I carried that with me all my life. And so when I was going through my amends, I said to myself, you need to make amends for this. So I researched what, you know, $30.78 was till now. And I contacted the now pastor and told him that, you know, told him my story and that I wanted to make amends for that. And if it was agreeable, I would fast forward that $30 into $2014 and make a $30 donation on top of it. And he was agreeable, and I said, well, before that, I ended the email with, and I'll send that to you, but if you want, I'll do it in person, which I didn't want to do in person. So he's like, how about you come to service this Sunday? I was like, okay, I can do that. So I go to service, and he instantly spots me out when I walk through the door. And takes me to his office, and he sits down and gets some history on me, and, you know, we talk for probably about 15, 20 minutes. And we go in, and he sits me next to a brother in the church, and, you know, we go through the service and everything, and then it's time for the collection. And he says, we have a visitor here today, and I want to introduce you to him. And he called me up. So I'm up front, and he introduces me. He's like, you know, hey, this is Andy. He used to be an Explorer Scouts. They met here at the church. He used to work at the booth, the fairgrounds. Well, they don't do it anymore, but there's a lot of old-timers in there going, yeah, I remember that. And he said, you know, he went on to have a naval career, retired as a naval officer, blah, 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 you know, and just built me up. And then he says, he's got a story to tell you guys. Yeah. And the surprising thing was I turned around, I didn't have a bit of anxiety or anything. And it was just so freeing to stand up in front of hundreds of people that I wronged and just take credit for that wrong that I did to them. And as I was telling my story, I could see the expressions on people's face. Some were just like, I can't believe. Others, tears were just running down their face. Others were smiling at me. And it was just the whole gambit of emotions as I was telling this story to them. And then afterwards, when I tried to walk out, it was just like, I couldn't get out for an hour for people coming up, hugging me, going, I can't believe the courage you had to get up and do that. And it was just like a love fest. But it was by far the most freeing amends I ever made in my entire life.
Again, when we think we know what an amends is going to look like and what God says an amends is going to look like are two very different things. And I think for me, the most amazing thing about amends is the fact that I have absolutely no control nor any right to have any expectation on the outcome, and thank God, because then I would certainly cheat myself out of something pretty gosh darn awesome. That's right, we had one more.
I was going to be getting my 10-year token in April, and I asked my dad, I said, would you like to come to that meeting? And he didn't say yes. He said it would be a privilege. Mm. And so both of my parents were at the meeting when I got my 10-year token.
That's awesome.
And yeah, so I mean, it's just, I just have an amazing relationship with them today that I had not had in 60 years.
Yeah, that's incredible. Okay, so who wants to talk a little bit about steps 10 and 11?
They're my favorites. We've been talking about them all weekend. You know, when we talked about, when I went over the Theater of Lie, I said, this is incredibly useful for your 10th step. Why, you know, we were talking about that. And I think, you know, we cheat ourselves. And this is, it goes back to this, like, you know, when I cut corners, I'm cutting more than corners. And I was taught, and this is like, so with certain things I'm liberal in terms of the big book and certain things I'm not. In the 10th step, I'm not very liberal about it. And my experience has been, because I'm not very liberal about it, I've had a tremendous experience with step 10. Now the promises of step 10 basically say that I'll cease fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. So all of those things that we talk about on page 60, 63 will diminish. And if you, and of course I know that a lot of you guys have heard this, if you compare the bedevilments found on page 52, the promises found at the end of the 9th step, we see that they're the exact opposite of each other for a reason. Because basically what's going on with me when I'm on page 52 will be resolved by taking the action that's set forth in this book between 52 and 84. 83 and 84. So, when we come to step 10, this is where it tells us we've entered the world of the spirit. So this, I don't have people wait till they finish their events to start doing step 10. I actually have people start doing step 10 pretty much. I mean, if you think about it, you have a conversation with me and you end up leaving on your 4th step, however long that conversation is, that's how long it takes. You know, so with that being said, typically people start doing step 10 pretty much when they start working the steps with me. Doesn't mean I don't sit down and read the book with people who have time or are clear. I do. But by that point, I already have you on step 10, because my thoughts are this, is that if you're watching for this stuff, when it comes time to write inventory and you've already done, had some experience with inventory and you're sitting and reading step 10 or working with step 10 on a daily basis, your inventory is going to have a lot of insight and you're not going to miss a whole lot because you're really aware of where you're falling short on a daily basis. But what I do find is that those who have had experience with inventory and amends, if you fail to do steps 10 and 11, chances are you'll either go batshit or drink in a matter of years, in a matter of time. Pretty much everybody that I know who has had that spiritual experience but eventually relapsed or picked up another ism in recovery has picked it up when they have not practiced these disciplines. But the way I always talk about it, or the way I was taught, is that our function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. So this is a growth step. This is where, if you think about it, think the 1 through 9 is the price of admission. 10, 11, and 12 is where the growth really happens. So when we look at this and we say, and it says we continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. So we continue to watch. Because Bill's assuming it's going to happen. So it's not a yes or no question. It's a where and when, not if. And I think that that actually helps me a tremendous amount because the first time I'd written inventory and I'd really gotten like really spiritually aligned and I was feeling fantastic and then I did something bonehead, I had a tremendous amount of shame. Because I would think, well, I did all this work and I'm still an idiot. Now, 20 years later, I go, I did all this work and I'm still an idiot. Okay. That's the name of the game, So when it says, when these crop up, we ask God to remove them. When, not if. We discuss them immediately with someone to make amends if we have harmed anyone. Discuss. That's one that we miss. I'll be talking to people and they'll tell me, they'll say, hey, Carrie, I've been doing inventory for years. I've done inventory standing in my head. I've done inventory in my own blood. I've done this inventory. And I've made amends, and I've done proxy amends, and I've done this amends and that amends. And I'll ask them, I'll say, well, tell me about how the 10th step shows up for you. And they go, oh, well, I make a list of bad stuff I do at night. I'm like, that's not the 10th step. The 10th step is about being present in the moment and becoming awake to the things that knock me off the beam and using the tools that I've been given in the previous steps to allow God to write me back on that beam. It goes back to the analogy I used with you guys that I'm the rock, God's the water. God's shaping me. But I have to be that rock. I have to sit still long enough for that to happen. And in order for me to do that, there's one thing that we need to do. And the one thing that we miss a lot, which is the discuss part of the 10th step. I'll watch. I'll ask. I'll amend and I'll turn. But I won't tell you. And there's a question in the nightly review. It says, is there something I should have discussed with another person? He says it twice. He says, discuss, and then did you discuss at the end of the day? Meaning that this is a really gosh darn important thing. Solitary self-appraisal is seldom sufficient. Bill says in the 5th step, if you don't do this, you'll likely drink. And then in 10 and 11, he says, did you discuss or discuss? And then 11, did you discuss? So this is an important thing, and we don't do it, do we? How many times did I fail to discuss something I should have? A lot. How many times did I pay a price for that? A lot. And so when that discuss part of the 10th step got factored in, my spiritual experience and my experience with step 10 changed tremendously. Guys, I have what I call 10 step buddies, and they're basically my buddies. There are people that I call, that call me, we text message. Text message is an awesome thing. And email's awesome too. And if I'm jammed up, I can't have my phone on me at work because I work in treatment and patients steal cell phones, call their drug dealers, and then they escape. No lie! So we got a locker phone in the car, we have to have it in our desk, right? Like I can't have my phone on me because they Google cold copying in Tannersville, Pennsylvania, and then they find out where to get drugs. I mean, they're ingenious people, So I have to be really careful about that. It's like being in a prison. You can't have stuff like that on you. So what do I do when I watch and I see and I'm, I find that I'm, you know, I found that I've been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, resentful. What do I do? Well, this is an awesome thing, right? So I see, I observe, right? I ask, I turn, I discuss, and I might say to one of my patients, you know, I'm really in my head right now. You know, you're talking to me, and quite frankly, and I'm really sorry, I'm not listening, because I'm thinking about my own selfish stuff. Something that simple. I remember sitting for an exam, and I was scared, so I turned to somebody in the classroom, and I said, you know what, I'm really projecting, I'm being really dishonest with myself, and I'm really invested in an outcome here. And as a result of that, I'm really jammed up and in my thoughts, and really, I'm just not living the kind of life that I want to be living, and I'm not on a spiritual beam right now. Is there anything I could do to be of service to you today? And of course, my fellow student knows I'm a complete wackadoo and just laughed her ass off. But, you know, we don't have to, like, you know, go to the mountaintops in order to discuss. It could be a simple conversation. It could be a, you know what, I'm in line, I'm impatient, and I turn to somebody next to me and say, you know what? Sometimes I think I'm so important and I'm so self-involved that I forget that there are other people in the universe. Would you like to go in front of me? You know, but for the big deal ones, for the heavy hitters, I have a 10-step. I have 10-step buddies. I get them all the time. In fact, I got a quarter of a bar while I was here, and I got 7 text messages, 4 of which were 10 steps from other people. So now I have to actually send them a text message to say, I'm really sorry, I'm in the wilds of Indiana. And,
you are.
I haven't ignored you. But so we do this, the discuss part, and there's a humility to it. Because we've become legends in our own minds, you know, and we do this work so much, we've become navel gazers so much, and we sponsor, and we're gurus, and we're this, and we're that. You know what? Use your sponsees as 10-step buddies. That's awesome, man. The first time my sponsor called me crying about some wackadoo stuff, I was like, I didn't know what to say. I was like, what? Did you pray? But here's the deal. We don't use each other as human toilets either. So the idea is I'm not calling you with my drama du jour. I'm calling you with my fourth column. I'm calling you for where I was selfish, dishonest, resentful, or afraid. Not with, did that bitch... She, you know, do you know what she did in that staff meeting? She blah, and blah, 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 blah. If I called my sponsor with that, I get hung up on. So I call with a, I am currently disconnected from God based on my selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. This is how selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear is showing up for me today. I prayed on it. I'm discussing it with you. Is there anything I could do to be of service to you today? And it's amazing how that changes my day. The other thing I do, and I told you guys that I had index cards, that I keep index cards, I keep them in my purse. Inventory cards. Now, let's just say, I get jammed up for real. And it's not just something I'm like, oh, I'm being a selfish jackass, I'm going to pick up the phone. I keep index cards. Little pieces of inventory I can write and get free right here, right now. Sometimes I have to put the pen to paper. At night I do, because at night we have 12 questions. And the first question was? Exactly. And if you answer yes, what do you got to do? Exactly. So basically at the end of the day it says, did I write inventory on the stuff I should have written inventory on? If not, should I write it now? And again, I've done the written nightly review. I've done the not written nightly review. I've done both. You know, I've done the do it in my mind. I don't like doing that. I like writing it out. I have like a little notebook. No one can read it because my handwriting is atrocious. And I like answering those questions. I think it helps. I have review buddies. We email each other our reviews. Now, I don't do that every night of the week. Like, I don't. You know, and mostly because I just forget sometimes. But there are periods of time when I make agreements with people in my life and we're like doing some serious spiritual work and it's, we email each other review. I get emailed reviews quite often, which prompts me to email a review. So the fact is I probably email my reviews at least 5 nights out of the week. You know, but it's not something that I'm doing as a spiritual commitment. It's just something that, or a spiritual practice as in like an exercise is just kind of how I do my reviews. Because the truth is that, and this is the thing, it helps me, keeps me humble. It also helps the person who's receiving my review. They point out things, ask me questions. I'll get an email back saying, can you consider? And you know, whenever somebody asks you, can you consider? It's probably yes. I probably am doing that. But it really helps. And the other thing too, in terms of sponsorship and having the email of the review, is what I've found is, one, that I'll get a lot of people who think they know how to write inventory but don't. And so when I get a nightly review and I'll get, were you selfish? Yes, but I was, or was I resentful? Yes, but selfish? No. I know they don't know how to write inventory. Or was I resentful? Yes, but no, I was not afraid. I know they don't have to write inventory. I love when they tell me that they're not dishonest at all. And I'm thinking, if you were resentful or selfish or frightened, you're inherently dishonest. You can't be selfish without being dishonest, because when I'm selfish, I'm taking whatever it is that you have I want, and it's mine. And that's dishonest, because it's not for me to decide what I have or want. That's me playing God. If I'm resentful, I'm dishonest, because I'm telling myself a story about you that makes me whatever. That's dishonest. I'm playing God. I have expectations and demands. You know, inevitably, if I'm resentful, I'm selfish and dishonest and frightened. If I'm frightened, I'm selfish and dishonest. If I'm, you know, they're kind of like, they all go hand in hand. So I find that when I get people doing a nightly review who tell me that although they are selfish, they are not dishonest, I know they don't know how to write inventory. Because I'll get people who have 20, 30 years who tell me that they've been through the work, and we're sitting down going through the work, and the first thing I do, first day, and I'm going through word by word, paragraph by paragraph, I'm doing the slow route. Because they tell me they know how to work the steps, and after I qualify them a little bit, I'll say to them, because you can't come right out and say, by the way, you have 30 years, and what you think you know about the steps would probably kill me. So why don't you just forget that and, like, you know, and just do it my way. Like, that I tried doing that, people would get really pissed off. So what I did was I say, hey, here's what I want you to do. While we're going through this work, and we're sitting reading the book, I want you to email me your nightly review. And most of the time I get, what's that? And then I get to have that conversation and say, well, do you not know, you know, have you been through the 10, do you know what the 10 step is? Do you know what prayer meditation? Where's your prayer meditation? And by virtue of asking those questions and having that conversation, they begin to see, hey, wait a minute, maybe I've been two-stepping it, you know. Or maybe I wrote an inventory that didn't include sex or harms or fear. Like, I don't know how many people have written resentment inventory but haven't written the other inventories. I have no experience with, don't even know what it is. And so they don't understand that fear and selfishness are connected, or that fear and resentment are connected, or that you can't have one without the other, that they all kind of come in a package. You know, they don't understand that, and that's where I get to have that conversation. But on the other side of it, when they're emailing me their nightly review, then I can kind of say to them, hey, you know, this came up in your review last night, let's take a look at that. And it helps them identify where they're stuck on the dash. You know, I'm powerless over alcohol, but I'm managing my life just fine. And when I can do that with a nightly review, that really helps me to get them to get in touch with that powerlessness, which is going to motivate them through the work. When you haven't had a drink in 30 years, and you've been telling yourself all kinds of stories about who you are to justify what you're doing, they're harder. Somebody with time who thinks they know the deal is so much harder to get through than the drunk who's crazy and chewing the walls. I mean, I'm basically the drunk who's crazy and chewing the walls in early recovery and just twitching. All I got to do is slow you down enough to give you some information, and you go berserk with it free, and everything's awesome. You know, with somebody with time who thinks they have an experience with the steps, who really actually hasn't been having an experience with the steps, but instead has been having an experience with their ego, they're really hard to get through because they think they know something. And when I think I know something, I'm usually screwed. And the problem is some people are so attached to their time they can't see it. So it's like, well, I have 25 years, I have 30 years, I have 21 years, I have 16 years. I have time. And I want to be like, well, let's look at quality rather than quantity. But in order to get people to look at the quality rather than quantity, doing the nightly review and having them email it or call it in to me or read it to me helps. It really helps me get them to touch that spot of them, to kind of see, hey, wait a minute. My alcoholic life seems like the only normal one. I can't differentiate the truth from the false. I've been rationalizing and justifying a lot of stuff that doesn't square with what I know to be true. And it's a really helpful sponsorship tool. So I definitely use it. But like I said, I love that question when it asks us. It says, did I keep something to myself that I should have shared? So I would think that if Bill asks us that question twice, that it's a really important thing for us to do. And I would beg you not to deprive yourself of the opportunity of applying that to your daily life. We don't have to make it crazy, but we can definitely do it. And like, and we do it to one another. Like, I'll literally pull my boss aside at this point. He knows. And I'm like, can I do a 10-step with you? Can I get a minute?
After sitting here thinking, you bad mouthing these old timers, you got all these fantasies.
Not you!
And Mike and I, a few years ago, were taking a few people through the book and the steps. And a man came in with 17 years for the very successful businessman. And but he had a little trouble in the AA because he was like a girl. Hadn't been helping him much, but he was really trying his very best to do it. He came in, the reason he came in at 17 years was the pain. Mm-hmm. And it really was, he had never, I don't think he, in his work, he'd never even opened a big book.
Yeah.
And got an awful lot of meetings, and he came in and he did some tremendous work, and he made some tremendous advancement.
Yeah.
And he's still on fire. And that was 20 years ago, wasn't it? Right.
Yeah.
With that. So, it's always what happened. Pain seems to be the real motivator.
Yeah. You're absolutely right on that.
Well, if I was going to walk up to somebody and say, why don't you try this? I know they're asking you to work.
Yeah. True. True.
The point is that the suffering alcoholic, I mean, as soon as the new guy or gal that's there, the suffering alcoholic is. Most of the time, the person
the
sitting in the room that's been there for years with no solution, and because they've got time, they can't admit they don't have a solution.
Yeah.
Their ego's got them trapped, and that's why old-timers don't drink, they commit suicide.
True.
They put the car in the garage and let the engine run.
True.
And I don't go any place where I don't hear that story right away, and it's happened down the block from me a couple years ago.
And you.
Somebody in our home group the other night, somebody doesn't usually show up, said something that was great. She said, when the pain of pain becomes greater than the pain of change.
Yeah.
Not until the pain of pain is greater than the pain of change does anything change.
True. Absolutely right. But one of the things that I found, and sometimes there are people who have that dramatic change, and a lot of times, and maybe this is an East Coast New York thing, it's, I want to sponsor du jour. I want a name brand. Unfortunately, I'm a name brand sponsor. And so what happens is people, you know, like Mike says, like, how many people do you sponsor, Mike? You said, like, half of them? When people ask you how many people sponsor you, half of them? Kind of like that. And with women, and I'm not trying to be sexist in any way, shape, or form, but a good sponsor is like a Prada bag, right? We want Prada, it's a special bag. They're like $2,000. They're really awesome. If you have one, your husband really loves you. I'm kidding. But the idea is that by us,
girlfriend.
Yeah.
by us, sometimes sponsorship can be, you know, confused with, you know, with an accessory. So a lot of times I'll get people who have time who ask me to sponsor them because they think I'm somebody. And I ain't nobody. My sponsor, he always used to tell me, Carrie, you're somebody, you're a nobody trying to be a somebody in a program full of nobodies, and that's pretty stupid. You know? You know, but people sometimes they don't understand what it is that we do, because, you know, they don't know what we do. So they don't understand that sitting in this chair is probably more humbling and vulnerable than sitting in that chair right now. You know, and that, you know, this isn't because I know so much, it's because I've made so many goddamn mistakes that I've collected enough to be able to tell you what not to do. So out by me, I get a lot of old timers who want to wear me like a Prada bag, but I use it against them. I Jedi mind trick them. They end up with a bedazzled big book and a gut punch, and I gut punch them with steps 10 and 11, with the nightly review, because we'll find out that, you know, they really have a throwaway phone, that they're having, like, you know, an affair with some guy that they met at the gym while their husband's at work, and, you know, they're living on Park Avenue and they have a shopping addiction, and by the way, they like to put their finger down their throat 37 times a day, you know, and these are things that come up, and because they look fine, it's all about, I'm on the outside, I'm going to trick you with the outside with a false advertising, and inside I'm a cesspool. And I can tap into that, and I use the fact that they think that I'm a Prada bag, and that I'm a name brand. And I was like, okay, you think you're gonna get a name brand? Come to my house. Come on. Let's have a conversation. You know? And then I let them hang themselves a little bit with their rope, and they're gonna tell me how spiritual they are, and then I start poking holes in that. And by the time I'm done poking holes with asking some questions and doing some things, all of a sudden, they're blubbering messes telling me about the 37 affairs in the garden, you know, the pool boy that they've been boffing, the Christian LeBron, what is it, Christian LeBron? What kind of shoes are they? The ones with the red soles. Christian something or other. Yes, thank you. I can't ever pronounce it. Those $400 shoes that they have hidden in their trunk that they don't want their husband to know about. Oh, see, I don't even know. Look, I wear like Abercrombie and Fitch. I'd be lucky if I could have, my car isn't even $400, I'm kidding. But my point to you is this. Is sometimes we can use that. We have the ones who are broken and know they're broken, and then we have the ones that think they're just fine and they're a little Dutch boy with the fingers in the dam. And these steps and this process can, these questions and the things that we were talking about this weekend can be a way to kind of wedge open that hole. And if you're open to hear it, you're gonna. One of the things that I really wanted to do with you guys this weekend, and is to, one of the things that gets short shrifted on these weekends a lot of times is meditation. And I think it's because there's so much to talk about, and we can go on and on. I can go on and on. I love talking about inventory because inventory is fun. I'm a therapist. I do inventory every day. I just charge people for it. Kidding. I'm really kidding. If I was as confrontational in therapy as I am in a fist step, I'd have no clients. Right, Tracy? A woman's gotta eat. But one of the things that we talk about meditation, and we all know that our lineage and the people who have taught us valued meditation, prayer and meditation, and kind of said, like, you know what, our failure to do this is often the thing that brings us back to the very thing that brought us into Alcoholics Anonymous anyway, which is either drinking or pain. But by virtue of my experience, and there's a line in our book, and it talks about, it says, you know, see where religious people are right. And I said that, you know, we talk about, I make cracks, and I said this book is non-conference approved, that book is non-conference approved, and, you know, we kind of make cracks about this. But, you know, part of what we're supposed to be doing when we get to this point is to start to explore other experiences and other ways of looking at spirituality. You know,
I don't know anybody who's actually had this true spiritual experience where they said, oh, this book is enough and I'm not going to look at anything else. In fact, most of the people that I know who have had this spiritual experience have become spiritual adventurers. You know, they're like, hey, a silent retreat? Cool, I don't have to talk to my wife, I'm going. You know? Hey, let's try this. Or there's a meditation class, or I can learn about chakras, or let me go to a Bible study, let me go to this, and let me go to that. And we become spiritual adventurers because we realize that they're just ideas, man. And if they don't fit, we can always put them right back down. Old ideas, or new ideas, don't have to become old ideas. They can just be ideas. And when you start to wear ideas like a loose garment, you become so open and open-minded to spiritual stuff. Because I can be sitting with you and you could be a fundamental Christian and I can be, you know, a dudist. There is something called dudism, by the way. Google it. It's based on the Big Lebowski. I could be a dudist and you could be a fundamental Christian and your reality and my dudism could absolutely exist at the same time in the same place because we're here for the same reasons. And because we have that experience here, I can hear what you have to say and you can hear what I have to say and we can agree on deep levels that our differences don't have to be that thing that drives us apart. It's our common solution, common peril that keeps us together. And that common solution is exploring God's universe. So you could be an atheist, and you could be the most devout person in the world, and you can exist together at the same time in the same place, and there doesn't have to be any conflict between the two of us. So one of the things that I like to do is guided meditation. It has been incredibly helpful to me. One of the guided meditations I have used over the years is actually out of 12 and 12. Holy crap, there is meditation in there. Did you know that?
No.
Bill uses guided meditation in the 12 and 12. He actually talks about going to a safe place and a beach, and he walks you through it, and then he actually uses the St. Francis prayer. So when we talk, when people say, well, you know, meditation doesn't say, it says prayer and meditation, then it says upon awakening, so there's no real meditation in the big, or in AA, I don't know what you're talking about. It's like, well, yeah, it's in the 12 and 12. I know we don't like reading that book, but sometimes there's some good stuff in there. And in the 12 and 12, it talks about using creative visualization as a meditation. And it talks about using the St. Francis prayer. And I don't know about you, but the St. Francis prayer is a prayer that I say every day of my life. And for me, if you had to ask me what my, like, mission statement is, I would have to tell you that the thing that comes closest to it is the prayer of St. Francis. Like, that to me is, like, my guide, my map, my morals. It's what when someone's doing something and they're not understanding me, I literally say, it's better to understand than be understood. You know, those words just come to me. So it's incredibly useful. Explore it. One of the things that I did and I was taught to do was to take one line from a prayer and take it into meditation and contemplation on a daily basis. So you could take the serenity prayer. You could take the third step prayer. How do you think the third step prayer and the way I break this stuff down? I'm not that smart, man. I took one aspect or one line from these prayers into meditation on a daily basis and said, you know, God, please show me some truth about that. And I would just sit with it. My creator was something I took into meditation. The spiritual terms in this book, we do that. So I took the prayer of St. Francis. And I do this on a pretty regular basis. I'll just really get time to do the prayer of St. Francis. And in the morning meditation, I'll take one line. And I'll watch for that throughout the day. So I kind of fold that one line into my 10th step or my watch for the day. Another fantastic tool, and I love index cards. Put the word pause or watch all over your car and your house and your bathroom mirror in front of the toilet or behind the toilet. You know, put those words: watch, pause, ask, turn, discuss. And I do that because it reminds me. on a daily basis. But it also reminds me, whenever I see the word pause, I have to say, where are my feet? Where's my head? Is my head where my feet are? Because if my head's not where my feet are, I'm not in the present moment, and therefore I'm locked off from that conduit between me and God. So I put these reminders throughout my house. I have indexed little stickers. I have a bell that dings on my phone every hour to just check in and just say, where am I with God? Am I in this present moment? How are we? Am I being God, or is God God right now? And it allows, what it does is it keeps me from going off the rails. And these are just very simple things we can do. So, with your permission, I'd like to bring you through a very short 5-minute guided meditation. Would that be something you'd be interested in doing? Okay. So we'll get comfortable. You're going to sit on your six bones. I'm kidding. I love saying six bones. So we're going to get, I want you to sit in any way that makes you comfortable. Lay, stand on your head, whatever it is. It's about being comfortable and kind of in your body. So I want you to kind of shake out your hands a little bit, wiggle your toes, right? And just kind of feel yourself. A lot of times we lose connection with our body. We lose connection, you know, we're so busy being in our heads, we forget that we actually are walking around in a sack of skin. So I want you to kind of like wiggle your butts in your chairs, kind of ground your feet on the floor, and just kind of get comfortable. Now, I typically, when I do meditation, I like to put my hands either facing up on my thighs or down. Really put them any way that you want to. Some of us use what we call the infinity mudra, which is we kind of just cup our hands like this. It's kind of like gathering power or energy from the universe. And again, just put your hands and your feet and shoulders in any way that's comfortable for you. And I want you to gently, very gently close your eyes. And what I would like you to do is take a deep breath. When you breathe in, I want you to feel your chest expand and feel your chest fill with air. And when you exhale, what I'd like you to do is to push the air out of your chest. I want you to feel the muscles, specifically your diaphragm, contracting and pushing the air out of your lungs. So as you breathe in, you feel your chest expand. And as you exhale, you feel the air rushing out of your body, and you can feel your chest deflate. So inhale, expansion. Exhale, deflation. In meditation, if you exhale longer than you inhale, you actually cause your body to pull in more oxygen. So that on your next inhale and exhale, I want you to exhale just a beat longer than you inhaled. So inhale, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Exhale, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Inhale. Exhale. On your next inhale, I want you to imagine white light flowing up through your nose, down your throat, and into your chest and filling your lungs. And on the exhale, I want you to feel black smoke flowing out of your chest, up to your throat, and out of your mouth, and into the air. As you breathe in, I want you to breathe in white light, white, healing, pure light. And as you exhale, I want you to imagine black smoke of resentment, fear, anxiety, shame, guilt, anything that you're holding on to that's just keeping you from feeling comfortable and free. I want you to imagine it to be burnt up by this white light and to be exhaled in black smoke.
So as you're breathing in, you're breathing in love. And as you breathe out, you're breathing out fear. With each inhale in, we're breathing in with love. And as you exhale, you're breathing out with fear. And after you've taken a few of those breaths, I want you to imagine on your next inhale to breathe in white light. And I want you to feel that white light going down your throat, down into your lungs. I want you to feel it filling your chest, moving on to your diaphragm, to your tummy, into your lower abdomen, and your hips. I want you to feel this white light filling, and especially right in the middle of your tummy, in your abdomen, right under your lungs, right where your ribs kind of end, and there has that little bow. There's that little spot there, right above your belly bone. And I want you to imagine that filled with white light. So as you breathe in, this white light keeps building. It's surging inside of you. And it's, imagine it filling every cell, every fiber of your being, everything that you are. So as you breathe it in, the cells in your body from your neck to your lower abdomen are filled with white light. Every organ, every sinew. I want you to imagine that white light traveling down to your sits bones and your hips. I want you to feel it at the top of your thighs and in your groin. And with each breath in, you feel this white light flowing down through your trunk, into your hips, and into your groin. And as it moves down, it moves through your thighs, and it penetrates all the muscle, the bone, the blood vessels, all of your flesh in your thighs. It moves to your lower thighs, to your knees, to your calves, your shins, your ankles, down to the very bottoms of your feet. I want you to imagine the bottoms of your feet imbued and filled with this white light. So all of you is glowing from the neck to the very tips of your toes. I want you to imagine this white light traveling back up through your feet, into your ankles, your calves, your knees, your thighs, your groin, your abdomen, your solar plexus, your chest, up to your shoulders. I want you to imagine it flowing down your back and your shoulders. And all the tension you're carrying in your shoulders just melts away. It goes down your arms, your biceps, your triceps, your bone, your radius, your ulna, your humerus, your elbow, your forearms, the palms of your hands to the tips of your fingers. To all of your body, from your neck to the tips of your toes, to the tips of your fingers, it's filled with white light, healing you. Healing every single cell, every molecule, everything that you are. And every time you exhale, all pain and tension and anxiety and fear just leaves you. I want you to imagine this white light traveling back up from your hands to your shoulders. And I really want you to imagine it in your throat right now. I want you to imagine your voice box filled with this white light. So that when you talk, it's filtered through love. I want you to imagine the white light moving up to your jaw, to the muscles in your face and your cheeks, and the muscles that attach your jaw. I want you to feel them. Just let go. I want you to feel your teeth and your tongue and the roof of your mouth. I want you to feel that be filled with white light, so that what comes into your mouth and what goes out of your mouth is filtered through love. I want you to imagine this white light traveling up to your cheeks, to your eyes, and your eyelids, your eyeballs, your eyelashes are filled with white light, so that all that you see is filtered through love. I want you to imagine this white light to move to your ears, and your ears are now imbued and filled with white light, and all that you hear is filtered through love. I want you to imagine that white light penetrating, going through your ear canal and into your brain. I want you to see your brain in all its beautiful glory. And I want you to imagine it being filled with white light. And all that you see, all that you think, all that you feel, all that you are, is filled with white light and love. I want you to see this white light move out through your eyes, up through your forehead, to the very, very top of your head, so that all that you are, all that you see, all that you think, all that you say, all that you do, all that you touch, and all that you walk on the earth with is imbued and filled with love. So that every fiber, every cell, every hair, every piece of you is filled with this love. And all fear and resentment, all pain that you're carrying inside of you, flows out of you in smoke till there's nothing left. And you are just glowing and vibrant with God's love and purity. I want you to sit in that moment and feel the vibrance of that in your whole body, in your whole being. I want you to take a deep breath. I want you to start bringing yourself back. You can open your eyes, wiggle your toes, kind of let go a little bit. And when you're ready, open your eyes and look around.
What'd you think? Is it useful? It kind of gets you into like a real place where your head, your mind, your soul, your body, and everything was all in the same place at the same time. It's a very easy meditation to do. They're really useful. Buddhists use a lot of white light meditation. We call it, I was taught to call it the love light meditation. It's got a whole other name that I can't pronounce.
I believe it was last year somebody brought up the prayer meditation using the cooking analogy of course. And then another retreat over there, they brought up the insightshammer.com, which is an app available just for this.
Yes.
And there is a group in there, Friends of Bill, and so if you want to look at it up and download the app, I've been using it now for about 3 months and very helpful.
There's another app called Calm. It's actually, yes, and it's, I use it on my phone a lot. It was as a suggestion of somebody in this room, because there are times, as a therapist, I hear some icky stuff. In fact, I hear ickier stuff at work than I have ever heard in Alcoholics Anonymous, because, just cause. And more than anything else, most of the time, the stuff that I hear at my, in my job, people are not necessarily willing to change. They're kind of like I was when I walked into my priest's, you know, office and I said, here are all the terrible things that people did to me. No, I don't want to be forgiven. Thank you very much. Have a nice day. And I was paying some spiritual prices for it.
and it was exhausting me. So Mike had suggested to me to schedule in 5 minutes after a debrief, a spiritual debrief or meditation, a quiet time after each one of these patients. But what I, and not to wait for the time when I felt like I needed it, but to make it a part of my day. The problem was, is that sometimes, you ever talk to a really toxic person? and you kind of take it on, you feel like icky inside, right? Now imagine you have to talk to 7, 8, 10, 15 of them a day. You know, so me being able to get into that spot where I can even take that deep breath and walk myself through one of these meditations was really hard to do. So I found this app, it's called Calm. And they actually have guided meditations very similar to this. They call it the body scan, which is a mindfulness meditation. And they have a timer. And they have, you can do it for 5 minutes, you can do it for 8 minutes, you can do it for 15 minutes, you can do it for 20 minutes. And they have several different kinds. And I really liked that because there might be a time when I could do a 15-minute meditation, there were times when I could do a 5-minute meditation. And I was trying to do the meditation, but I was finding that the spiritual residue that I was being left in my office at the time, which I have also started to put sage in my office. There's things I've actually started to do, I had to do, as part of me practicing self-care at the suggestion of this very brilliant man that I never occurred to me in my spiritual giantness to do. Like I said, how do you know what you don't know? Until somebody actually points something out, and you're like, oh, that's absolute common sense. So what I did is I have that app and I use it, and it's very helpful because it actually gets me right into that quiet place, and I don't have to do all the, you know, shaking and moving around and getting quiet, because by the time I did that, somebody's knocking my door saying, Carrie! I'm like, fuck, I haven't even gotten to the meditative place yet. So yeah, these apps can be really helpful, and they have different times on them. YouTube has a ton. YouTube has a lot of guided meditation. It's incredibly useful. We have technology. Take meditation classes. How do you think I learned how to do that? I'm not that smart. I took classes in it. And it had nothing to do with my job. It was actually at classes that I took at a Buddhist temple. You know? But there are all different kinds. I've actually studied Indian contemplative meditation. I don't know if you ever heard of a guy named Thomas Merton. Yeah. He's one of my favorite writers. He's one of my favorite spirits. And he had this conversation with a guy named Thich Nhat Hanh, who is like, it was called Living Buddha, Living, yeah, thank you. I was going to say, I almost want to say Buddha, there's also, he wrote another book called The Buddha's Heart, but there's a book called Living Buddha, Living Christ, and what it was basically two monks having a conversation about their beliefs, and about the similarities and differences, but more than anything else about the love and compassion they had for their fellow man. And it's a really, really beautiful piece of work. And so I've actually worked with people, with Christians, and done contemplative meditation, as well as Buddhist, as well as yoga, as well as whatever fits you. But we need to do it. But I told you that this is a recipe, right? So I just gave you, I served you up like a chocolate truffle that maybe I would put on top of the cake. The cake begins with a simple question, you know, upon awakening, right? Upon awakening, what are my plans for the day? The greatest meditation, the greatest tool that I have ever used is the Oxford Group Meditation. There's a book. It's called How to Listen to God. There's a pamphlet. This is AA group literature, by the way. It's non-conflict group literature because Cleveland publishes a pamphlet. There's two of them. There's called The Four Absolutes, which was awesome, and How to Listen to God. And I found it at a table in a conference in Ohio. So I figured this is not non-conference approved because I found it at a conference.
By the way, our mutual friend from Colorado would often make the point that all conference approved means is that at one time a conference of drunks.
True.
Said this reflects our collective experience. Non-conference approved literature that saying something is not conference approved is in no way negative. It just may reflect individual experience rather than group experience.
Absolutely.
So conference group, all it means is we all agree on that.
Well, could we as a conference get rid of living sober?
I vote for that.
I use it as toilet paper and sometimes kindling. I'm kidding! I hate Living Sober though. That's one of those books where I was like, what were they thinking? But maybe, I felt that way about 12 and 12, and I'm now different about it. So who knows, maybe in another 20 years, I'll be reading Living Sober.
It'll be on your relative list.
Anyway, I walk into a meeting and it's a Living Sober meeting. I'm like, crap! But that's just me because I'm not a nice person. So we want to start with that recipe, and we want to use what the book lays out, and then we want to add to it. So the idea is the Oxford Group Meditation. Dick B wrote a book. It was actually Ann Smith's journal, wasn't it? And he actually found Ann Smith's journal, and he published it in a guide for meditation using the Oxford Group Meditation. There are some Oxford Group literature such as Soul Surgery, great book. Was another one, some about drummer, like marching to your own drummer. Oh gosh, I forgot the name of that one. I got it at home too. It's like right on my toilet. It's a little meditation book. It's incredible. So the Oxford Group has some pretty incredible literature, and of course that's what informed the way that we actually lay out meditation in the big book. Because that was the kind of prayer and guidance they used, which was the how to listen to God, sit quiet, ask God for direction for your day, write down what came to your mind, and then compare it to the four absolutes, absolute purity, absolute unselfishness, absolute love, and absolute honesty. And of course, the 10th step is the exact opposite of the four absolutes. So Bill, like, said, instead of having us try to live up to these ideals because we know we're not going to be able to do it, instead he asked us to look for what we didn't. You know, which is selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear, which is the exact opposite of the four absolutes. So we have quiet time and guidance, and we use the four absolutes to guide our behavior. The four absolutes can be found in the big book. It's actually found in the stories, and it's also found in the preface. I believe it's found in the first... No, actually, those are the tenets of the Oxford Group. But the four absolutes can be found in the stories. It could also be found in, I believe, I want to say it's either AA Comes of Age or Dr. Bob and the Old Timers. I was first introduced to it by Ernest Kurtz in Not God, which is a non-conference approved book, but a really great one.
Probably the best history book
we've had. It is. Well, when you said, when I met you, Gary, and I said, oh my God, I said, oh God, oh my God, right? And you said, not God, and I just laughed to myself because I was like, I like him. He reads the same kind of books I read. So they actually, Not God and How to Listen to God. And How to Listen to God, I believe there was a book published by Wally P. That actually goes through in great detail how to do an Oxford Group meditation. So I like to start with that. I think that the sitting quiet, and I already have a pad next to my nightstand at night because I wrote my nightly review. So it's pretty easy for me to pick up that pad in the morning and say, okay, what kind of amends do I have to make for whatever I did yesterday that I didn't clean up? What's my plan for the day? And do a meditation like that. It takes me just a few minutes. And then I usually do either some form of yoga or I do a creative visualization very similar to what I guided you guys through today. You know. But more than anything else, what I do read is 84 to 88 on a daily basis. And typically I read it in prayer form. I start at step 10. And I do that, this thought brings me to step 10, and then I read the instructions or the considerations, and I read it as requesting God to help me in this with these specific instructions. So it goes, this thought brings me to step 10. God, please help me to continue to take personal inventory and set right in new mistakes as I go along. Please help me to vigorously commence this way of living as I clean up the past. Help me to enter and live in the world of spirit. Please help me to grow in understanding of effectiveness. This is not an overnight matter. Please help me to continue it for a lifetime. Please help me to continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When they crop up, please remove them.
Please help me to discuss them immediately with someone to make amends if I have harmed anyone. Help me to resolutely turn my thoughts to someone I can help. Help me to live with the love and tolerance of others as my code. Help me to cease fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. And we go on. And I read grade 84 to 88. And a prayer form. I do a quick Oxford group meditation. It takes 2 minutes. Take a few minutes quiet time in the morning just to get with my breath in my present minute, in the present moment. I can do, you can do a vision, you can sit with your breath. What I was taught to do in terms of getting quiet was start with an egg timer, you know? Like literally set the timer for 3 minutes and just sit for 3 minutes. Even if your mind goes all over the place, just sit. It's discipline. If anything, it teaches you how to sit through a open disgusting meeting without raising your hand and yelling at people and telling them they're wrong. If you learn how to sit quiet for a few minutes, then you can use that when you're in a meeting and you're about ready to strangle someone who's killing alcoholics for telling them not to work the steps and shit like that. I very often use that. In fact, people will recognize, they're like, wow, Carrie must be pissed off at that guy because she just closed her eyes and got quiet. I could see her with her meditation. I was going to say I was kidding, but I'm not. I actually use getting quiet sometimes in meetings when I'm with somebody saying something that I'm like, I'm responsible for fixing that and I got to prevent people from killing each other or killing. And I'm realizing like, hey, I'm not God. This is not the right approach. One needs to bring love rather than judgment. And sometimes just by getting quiet with my breath in that moment, I'm able to do that. So practicing this in the mornings is a really, really useful tool. But like I said, this is a recipe. So a fundamental aspect of this recipe is asking God to direct our day. Requesting God that we have God direct our thinking. You know, that's a fundamental aspect of it. What you add to it, what you bring to it, what kind of seasonings you put into your recipe, that's about you and God. But we keep to the fundamental things, because I have met many a people who have said, well, I've moved beyond meditation, my day is a meditation. And I was like, no, your day's a train wreck, man. You know, and my day is a meditation. I stop every hour or so, I have a bing that goes off my phone that tells me to check in with God. It takes a second. I don't know how many times I've been in the ladies' room hitting my knees because I needed to ask God for the power of grace or to do something, or I had to do a 10-step and there was something that I had to do with that. You know, our days are living meditations, absolutely. Our days are walking prayers, absolutely. So meditate and pray. Duh! You know? So it's a matter of finding what works. But I ask you please not to throw the baby out with the bathwater just because you have a brand new toy. Not to not do what the first 100 alcoholics did, because they seem to be pretty good at it and they were getting some pretty decent results. So I like to keep it to that. And I think that, you know, I did not get to talk a whole lot about step 12, but I think all we did was talk about step 12 the entire damn weekend. You know? I kind of want to wrap it up with this. There's a cyclical thing to the steps. And if we're not carrying this message, and if I say I have an experience, say, you know, I have this tremendous experience with God and others, right? And then I go home and I say, well, I'm too busy to actually have an experience with God or to carry this message or to help another alcoholic because my life is really full because God's given me back all the things that I wanted back when I started this process. And God is beautiful enough to do that. In fact, God has given me more than I ever could possibly have conceived of. And the most selfish thing I could do with that is to take my ball and go home and not put my hand out to the newcomer or to the person struggling. Me today, I specialize in the old-timers. The old-timers who maybe need a spring cleaning. And I think part of it is because most of the people who are newcomers in my area or have at some point, my treatment center is very large and I live very close to it. They have some association with my treatment center, and it's a violation of my ethics. I'm not allowed to have a dual relationship with them. And that's one of the things I've grieved most in my recovery. So I do sponsor new people but I have to be very careful about how I do it. So what I tend to do is send them to my sponsees, and I tend to keep the old-timers. I tend to keep, and I mean old-timers, I mean people who have a couple of years of sobriety but are stark, raving, insane, and walking fire hazards. And I tend to keep those, and that keeps me out of ethical trouble, and I don't get sued. And I still get to be on the firing line of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I will tell you what, a walking fire hazard is a lot more work than a crazy, squirrely newcomer. Crazy, squirrely newcomers know they're crazy. Walking fire hazards think everybody else is crazy. You know what I mean? You know, like spontaneously combust because they're so dry.
Can we get your contact information?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. You know, so I specialize in that, and that's my 12 step. But here's the deal: if I'm not in my 12 step, I'm not in my first step, am I? If I'm in my first step, I'm in my 12 step. Because that desperation to carry this message, that desperation to be a part of God, to help God's children, right? If I lose that, I have lost the reason why I came into these rooms, the reason why my ass is in this chair. And if I'm in my first step and I have a solution to a problem that is killing millions of people, then I'm going to want to share that, aren't I? So my first step is your 12th step. Your 12th step is my first step. And if I'm in the 12th step, meaning I have done all the work that has led up to me being in that 12th step, I will never lose my first step. Because I will stare alcoholism in its eye every moment of every day. My contact information is spiritfire76.
Can you write it up on there?
I will.
Thanks.
I will write it. But for the tape, it's spiritfire76@msn.com. And my phone number is 570-242-0352. I want to thank you for this incredible weekend. I want to thank you for allowing me to participate in your recovery and then participate in your spiritual life. I have had a tremendous amount of fun. I hope that I brought you a very abnormal meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to give one shout out, and I think it's incredibly awesome. The women that I've met here are in the trenches, and I really love that. Because I don't know, you know, we're talking about saying why are so many guys sponsoring me, right? And part of the reason why so many guys sponsor me is because the women go home and they don't come out and play. And they do that because they caretake. Women think sponsorship is motherhood, and it's not. I'm not taking care of you, you know. I'll get sponsored. People call me up, and they're like, aren't you supposed to listen to my problems? I said, fuck no, who told you that? I'm supposed to guide you through the steps. Listening to your problems, you got to pay somebody to do that. Now, if you want to meet me at... hell no. Well, because if you start listening to their problems, then they find more problems. Fuck that. You know, so I'm tough. Like that. I'm loved and hated where I live. But one of the things that I find is that, you know, women will have this experience, we'll get some stuff back, and then I'll sit at a meeting, and there's somebody who, you know, was in the trenches 2 months ago or 2 years ago, and she's telling me about how, you know, she goes to the gym and about how she meets with her nutritionist and how she has, how her new bikini wax or Brazilian wax is working out for her, but she doesn't have time to sponsor. And I think to myself, I'm like, you know, there are women who are dying and you're busy waxing your fucking vagina. You know, no offense to you. I did it, Mike, sorry. Heather Eckert. But, you know, no offense to you. I'm in the trenches. My girls are in the trenches. My girls are in the trenches. And I don't care how my vagina looks because I'm a child of God. And I don't got to spend time fixing up the outside to distract you from the fact that I'm empty on the inside. And the women in this room, they're not doing that. They're the real deal, and I love that. I absolutely love that. There's not a woman in here who's fake. There's not a woman in here who's trying to distract me from the fact that they feel like they're nothing because they feel like they are someone. They are children of God, and they're out there doing the deal as hardcore and as tough as the men. And I love that. Because everybody, you know, everyone thinks that we're supposed to be these sweet Oprah book reading, book clubbing, you know, little dainty darlings. And no offense, but when I'm throwing up on your shoes and stealing your wallet, I ain't that dainty. And I love the fact that you guys are doing, you're doing the real deal, and you're girls of my ilk. And I just want to thank you for, you know, for reminding me that, that there are some real deal women in Alcoholics Anonymous. So thank you.
Thank you.